Good morning and welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show on 88.5 FM. Back in 1951, Maurice Sendak illustrated Marcel Aimé's book, The Wonderful Farm. That was just the beginning. Since then, he's illustrated about 70 for other writers, plus written and illustrated a dozen of his own. A man who began life as a sickly, miserable child, Sendak's genius is to portray children as they are, struggling to cope with both the triumphs and terrors of childhood. One of the best-selling children's books of all times, Where the Wild Things Are, generated a great deal of concern and controversy among adults who felt Sendak's wild things were too terrifying and ferocious for young children. In 1981, he designed the sets and costumes for the Pacific Northwest Ballet's Christmas production of Nutcracker. Then in 1984, Harmony Books published E.T.A. Hoffman's version of Nutcracker with interpretive illustrations by Maurice Sendak. Now it's out in paperback, and Maurice Sendak is here with me. We'll take your calls. You can join us between now and 12 noon, 885-8850. Can't tell you what a pleasure it is to have you here, Mr. Sendak.
Thank you, Diane.
You had done three operas and one off-Broadway musical for children. I gather you weren't particularly enthusiastic about doing Nutcracker the ballet when it came up.
No, I wasn't originally, because I was like so many people who had to take children to the ballet in New York, and it was so tiresome. I'm not Tchaikovsky, who was extraordinary. But most often you'd have to close your eyes and concentrate on Tchaikovsky and not what was going on stage, which never had any dramatic harmony, which never had any intrinsic force to it. So, of course, when I was approached, I saw no reason to do it until the choreographer upped the ante and said, we're going to change the whole thing. It was very brave of him because he was sort of new there. But the idea of changing, for me, meant historical work and research, going back to the original German fairy tale. I mean, Hoffmann's a genius, and neglected, actually, except for maybe a handful of short stories. So in rereading Nutcracker, finding how wonderfully bizarre and ironical it was, and that sourness was totally missing from the production on stage, and maybe intended because it was supposed to be a Christmas trifle. I couldn't deal with a Christmas trifle. And so we filled it up. We took as much of the story as we could and dramatized it on stage between me and Kent, he taking care of the choreography and me taking care of the dramatic action. We had something that I could enjoy, that I could take somebody to go see. And more important, it's a ballet about a little girl, and she stays front center for the entire work.
And then, of course, you were forced to change hats from designer to illustrator to create this latest book version of Nutcracker.
I normally would not have done that because that would have been repetitive. But in this particular case, there was so much from Hoffmann that I could not get on stage. There was just so much yardage of Tchaikovsky. So that now, in illustrating the book, I could fill in all those marvelous, bizarre, dark little chapters and draw pictures. So it's like having your cake and eating it, to do the ballet and then the fat, fulsome fairy tale. It was terribly tempting. And I had a marvelous time with the ballet and the fairy tale, illustrating the book. And it's so beautifully manufactured. I must say
it is.
Because
it's
Crown
gorgeous.
Did the most gorgeous manufacturing job. And the paper edition, which I held back on for a while, looks so beautiful.
I am very impressed with it. However, I have to tell you that when the hardback edition first came out, each person in my family, and there are four of us, there were four of us at the time, we are now five, each person gave it to everybody else without anybody knowing it. So we ended up with four copies of it. And it is absolutely gorgeous in paperback as it is in hardback. I want to go back to Where the Wild Things Are, copies of which are right here in front of me. We have it going back to 1963 when it first came out. The fact that it is still in print nearly 30 years after publication must give you a great deal of satisfaction.
It's marvelous. I did that book when I was 30. I'm 63. I'm still enjoying it. When I'm autographing, I've been on a book tour, as you know, and some of it is autographing books, which is difficult and tedious work, but it's mitigated by the fact of people coming forward with kind of radiating faces and almost nonverbal reactions to that book, which had been such a private part of their childhood. It's very moving. It's very touching.
Well, I must say, our children were born in 1960 and 1964, and it remains among their favorites. And as I said, it is one of the top 10 best-selling children's books of all times. Now, some people have said that your characters are thrilling to children and controversial to adults.
Yes, that's perfectly
now,
accurate.
Now, having you here, I want to hear your reaction to that.
I think that's accurately put. Adults seem to have very faulty memories about their own childhood, and maybe that's the way it has to be. And certainly when you become a parent, the first instinct is to protect your child from anything harmful. It's perfectly natural, except that you can't, for the most part. And I think to be thoroughly honest with children and attach yourself to them or identify with their problems and recollect accurately what childhood was like, which is some nice things and some not such nice things. And that has to be. That's the nature of living. So if Wild Things addressed both those issues, the kids were grateful because somebody was being honest with them about that moment when all is lost. It might just be a meager 10-second temper tantrum, but it's crucial in a child's life when his mother does not understand his need. He doesn't have the logic that goes beyond and says everything will be all right in 20 minutes. It's that critical moment. And I've written about that critical moment in every book I have written. It's the moment that intrigues me dramatically as an artist. Adults only see the obvious things, the teeth and the claws and all those things that will frighten their kids, they think. And let me assure you, there are some children who are frightened by this book. But then we're all different in terms of taste, and there's no reason a child should be subjected to a book that scares him or her.
The attack on you from Bruno Bettelheim, yeah, which goes way back, and he said you were creating anxiety-producing scenes of desertion in Wild Things, and he scolded you there.
Severely, and for a young man and a young career and his first major work, that was a very serious and traumatic moment for me. I didn't know how to deal with that at all. This was a major figure. And he has been a major figure in our country for a long time. I met him, oddly enough, some brief years ago when I was given an honorary degree. And he was, too, at the very same place. And we could finally shake hands. And we talked about the uses of enchantment and how he'd come about to writing that book and how he felt maybe he'd been rather harsh on me in the old days. But then he pulled himself together and said with his very heavy accent, I must tell you, I still do not like your book at all. So I rather admired his stiff-necked attitude. He wasn't going to shift ground.
How did you recover from that internally? I mean, I would have felt like a terribly wounded child/adult if that had come from Bettelheim.
There were two things. One, I knew how good it was. Honestly, that would not have sufficed because I neither had the inner strength nor the outer clout to have survived that. I did have Ursula Nordstrom, who was my editor, who was one of the bravest, toughest, most marvelous human beings that ever lived. And she pulled me up short, and she taught me a lesson about living and critics and surviving. She reminded me of what had happened during the book and the joy it had given me and her to work together on this thing, and she was not going to have me backslide. She was not. And the fact that In the Night Kitchen was the next book proves clearly that I was not frightened after a certain point.
And, of course, I have copies here of In the Night Kitchen, which I am so troubled to hear that librarians are covering up this little boy.
They were covering up his genitalia in 1970 when it was a breakthrough that there was a naked kid. We had not intended, neither me nor Ursula, to have anything so asininely controversial. That seemed to be the least of the book. The fact that it became the most important aspect of the book was embarrassing because it's a work I love, and it was a serious work. It took 7 years to bring about after Where the Wild Things Are. And then to have all the fuss over his penis was humiliating, quite frankly. Now it continues, you see. Now it continues. The same atmosphere is, this is a minority thing. It's not a majority thing. But it's enough to constantly irk you and depress you, that people will not see the size of the book and will diminish it. And of course, if you, a teacher or whoever does the magic markering over Mickey's privates, all you're doing is having little children hold the book up to the light to see what in hell has been covered up, and then drawing their attention to exactly what they wish to detract them from. If they just let it alone, since children are, they rather enjoy their bodies until perhaps later we teach them not to, for some obscure reason, they just go right through the book. They don't even notice it, except that maybe a little girl will titter. That's about the worst you'll get. But they have such a clean comprehension and appreciation of their bodies that is not their problem.
I'm sure from time to time you have been in situations where you could debate librarians about this issue.
Yep, I certainly have. And it's frightening sometimes, the mindset on these people and the obdurate idea that I did it for scandalous reasons, for self-aggrandizement, to draw attention to myself. And it's hard to take. But the book still goes.
The book certainly does still go. I said to you when you first came in the studio, you had been scheduled to come in here 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I've been doing the show now for 12 years. You were scheduled to come in here in 1981. After Outside Over There had been published, and at the end of your tour, you were supposed to come here, and you fell ill and went back to New York early. I was so disappointed. It's the only time in my entire career that I have saved a script, and I went back to my files and pulled out that 1981 script, and there it was.
I'd like to see it.
I will show it to you. I will show it to you. Outside Over There, I was looking at it again this morning, and that first scene, I am struck by the similarity, at least in my own mind, to John Fowles, the French lieutenant's woman.
That's interesting.
With this young child standing on what looks like a promontory, watching as her father's ship sails away. Mm-hmm. Did that come into your own mind? It never did.
No, it never did. But it's an interesting association on your part, and I can see the connection. It was really a romance. I was involved with romantic painting, early German romantic painting of the 19th century, falling quite in love with it. And I wanted to take from that as much as possible and bury my powerful theme from Outside Over There into a very lush and romantic setting. Not so different from that novel that you mentioned. And that's what I achieved in that book, or tried to achieve. That was the last of the trilogy. And although there are some people wonder why it's a trilogy, true, it's not like Rambo 1, 2, and 3. Sylvester Stallone does not appear in each one. It's a trilogy in the sense of what I described to you earlier, of a peculiar, exquisite moment in the child's life. It may take a half a second. Mama and Papa may not even notice it even happened, where that kid has to make a decision based on no logic, no experience, but only trust and love. He can count on that from his parents. And he has to take a dive and do something a little bit illogical. Max runs up against his mother, gets punished for it, and has this inflammatory fantasy about the wild things. Mickey takes a dive literally and trust that he's going to land safe and accomplish something. Ida, she's the eldest, and her problem is much more complicated. The trilogy really has to do with Max, me as a baby, Mickey, my brother, a tiny bit older, and Ida, Natalie, my sister, the eldest. So it's really the three of us, basically, and how each book gets more complicated because each child gets a little bit older. And Ida being the eldest, her complexity. I love that book so much because I could enter into my sister's spirit.
The reception for these three books was different.
All different.
Most especially for Outside.
Outside
Over There
was the most puzzling and, without question, the least popular of any of the works I've done. But that is disappointing to me, but it has never relaxed my hold on that book in terms of what I know what I've accomplished in it as an artist.
Why do you feel the reception was diminished for
because
that?
It's an ambiguous book. It does not have a clear, precise ending. It is not a happy book in the way people think children's books ought to be, upbeat and happy. It tells a story that is rather somber, but to me very beautiful. But I was in a position of artistic control at this point that I wasn't going to miss doing it. And since I didn't count on sales of books, that wasn't part of my career plan. You can only be disappointed not in the lack of sales, but in the lack of appreciation for what you feel as an artist is the very best that you have to give.
Maurice Sendak is with me, and I know most of you are familiar with his books, Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, Outside Over There. Now we are talking about a brand new paperback version of E.T.A. Hoffman's Nutcracker with interpretive illustrations, pictures, as he calls them, by Maurice Sendak. You can join us. Call us between now and noon, 885-8850. You described your own childhood as, in places I've seen, is not a terribly happy one. Less outgoing than we would expect children to be. You were a sickly young fellow.
Yeah, but I think it has to be put in perspective that I was a 30s baby, and there was no sulfa drugs or penicillin. So I wasn't so strangely sick. It was that most of us were. You know, we got the whooping cough and scarlet fever and pneumonia, dreadful diseases, and lots of us didn't make it. It left my heart permanently damaged. But as a matter of fact, it was fairly typical of the time. What was perhaps untypical was the awareness on my part from a very early age that I was so fragile I might not live. So I overheard my mother's prayers and tears and conversations about the loss, the potential loss of me and how delicate. And I knew I could die. I knew I could die at too early an age when children might suspect that, or when children are more concerned about the loss of their mothers and fathers or their dogs and their cats or their grandmas, but not of themselves. That came too early. But I don't blame them for that because they were very straightforward people. They didn't spare me anything. And it's somehow what I've done to my audience, too. I've been very clear and straight in a way that has, you know, annoyed people. Absolutely.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That you shouldn't be this clear to children. But see, I've never set out to write books for children. I never set out to do, this is my life's work. I'm going to write just for children. I didn't categorize myself. And I've never categorized them because I was never categorized as a child. My father and mother told us everything they could tell us to prepare us for life. Okay? And that somehow went into the body of work that I did. So to be shoved into a little ghetto of kiddie bookland is irritating, and I refuse to be there.
What does that mean? Your mother and father told you everything you needed to know to be prepared for
how
life.
Hard it was going to be. How difficult it was going to be to survive, simply to earn a living, because they had found it so hard. My parents, my father lost every member of his family to the Holocaust. They worked so hard to bring their families over, and of course they began with my mother's family, and they got most of her people here except her brother who died. And then when they were just to begin on my father's family, it was too late. So the death of families, the death of people on the other side, the death of children who were my age, but by the sheer quixotic nature of it, I was on one side of the ocean and they on the other, really burned a hole in my brain. It was that kind of thing. If I was bad, if I was spoiled, if I was stubborn, I was told in no uncertain terms the great good fortune I had at even being alive. And were I there, I would be in an oven. Those are hard things to take.
You spent a lot of time looking out the window, watching.
Spent a lot of time looking out the window. When you're not strong, that's what you do. And every book I've done has a window in it. Kenny's Window was the first book I wrote and illustrated. Ida plays a magic horn out her window. There are windows galore in all the books because it was my companion. Looking out in the street and watching life's parade was pretty much what I was going to have to do.
You finished high school, but you vowed never to go to college.
Vowed never to
Why?
Go to college. Because I hated school so much. There is a regret now because I don't speak languages. My education is full of holes. And now, at my advanced age, I could enjoy college because I don't have that paranoia about school. But it was terrible back then. I was misunderstood, like a lot of kids. I was left-handed, which was considered deficient and stupid, made to sit in back of the room. You were made to feel all the time inadequate and constantly competing with the brighter right-handed children. Impossible situation to grow up in. Impossible situation. And the only thing you could do is what I did, which was to totally retreat into myself, be belligerent, hostile. And then when the teachers became interesting and warm, I didn't trust them. I didn't think there could be such a thing. And they were. Some of them are still my friends. My English teacher in high school, who made every effort, this woman, to engage me. I wouldn't let her in. No way. It was too late.
I didn't go to college either. And through doing this show, I feel as though I've had the benefit of private tutors every day. You could enjoy private tutors, perhaps.
Oh, yes. But also, probably like you, since I was so aware of not going to college, and I'm a great reader and devourer of literature, that I do more homework than any college student could do to improve myself. And I spent my entire life improving myself and enriching my appetite for reading.
You actually designed toys for a while because after you left high school, you went to FAO Schwartz.
Yeah. I was going to be a toy designer with my brother. My brother Jack is 5 years older than I and my very best friend in the whole world. We were going to be the little toy maker brothers. And he made the mechanical aspects of it, which were totally ingenious. Little Red Riding Hood coming into Grandma's room, and she stands there, and you pull a lever, and the wolf comes rearing out of the bed, and she collapses in a dead faint. Then you push the lever back, and then you do the whole thing again. It was impossible to reproduce and commercially make. They were just handcrafted wooden toys. My brother has three, and I keep three. They're moldering because my nephew and niece played with them. They're wrecks. But nevertheless, I got a proper job there at FAO Schwartz when I couldn't sell my work as a young man. And I worked in the toy store.
And then your first break as an illustrator came?
Was the book you mentioned.
Marcel Aimé's.
Marcel Aimé, The Wonderful Farm. That Ursula Nordstrom, the first thing she gave me. I had no experience. She was undaunted. She rather loved the challenge of an ignorant, rough kid who she could train. That was her thing.
But what about the connection between toy making, FAO Schwartz, and illustrating? Well, How did that come?
Well, I worked in the window display department, and I stuffed the windows full of drawings. I was luring somebody, and I lured Ursula into the store. She was curious about those pictures in the window and spoke to this wonderful, brave, marvelous woman named Frances Christie, who was then book buyer at the store. And Frances was my mentor because that book department in those days was the best in the country, best children's department. And Frances brought about the liaison between me and Ursula, and that friendship began. I've lost both these friends quite recently.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it's really hard. It's really hard to do without them because probably a part of my most personal history as an artist.
Maurice Sendak is with me, and we'll open the phones now. Take your calls between now and noon. Join us on 885-8850. There is a brand new paperback version of E.T.A. Hoffman's Nutcracker, and, of course, with the most glorious illustrations by Maurice Sendak. Good morning, Martha. You're on the air.
I'm so thrilled to be able to talk to Mr. Sendak.
I can appreciate that. I feel the same way.
I was born in 1950, and I still remember being having A Hole is to Dig read to me, and now we're reading it to our 4-year-old son. And actually, at the moment, we're reading What Do You Say, Dear?, the illustration that you did for that. Mm-hmm. And he loves Where the Wild Things Are, and actually, for baby presents, I only buy the Nutshell Library, which he knows completely by heart.
That's lovely.
And I just wanted to tell you, you've made it just such a wonderful contribution to our family life. I just can't even begin to tell you. I only had one question.
Yep.
I read in a biography of you that that the faces of the wild things were in fact based on relatives in your home when you were growing up, and there's the long story about how you had to sit around and keep them company while your mother, who was a very slow cook, was off in the kitchen. Is that really true?
That's really true. While she was slow cooking, they were pinching my face and my brother's face and my sister's face and their crude, rough, fat, red hands and saying, "You look so good, we could eat you up," and we knew they'd eat anything. So it was a problem.
Thanks.
I exercised them in that book.
Thanks,
well,
Martha.
Thank you so much for all your work. We just all love it, and we'll continue to. We have a baby now, and I'm sure, she has Where the Wild Things Are poster in her room.
Good. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank
Chris,
you.
You're on the air.
Hi, I feel as Martha did about his books. They're great.
Good, I'm glad.
The one that just moved me, almost I couldn't finish reading it, was Dear Millie. And my middle daughter is enthralled with that book. How did you come across the story?
The story was in a letter Wilhelm Grimm wrote to a little girl in 1816, and it never ended up in any of the collections because it was in a letter, so nobody knew the story existed. And we had the great good luck of finding out about the letter and having an American dealer purchase the letter, bringing it to America, and the United States being the first country to publish this manuscript. And it's just come out in Germany to very interesting reviews 3 years after the American edition. And, of course, I fell in love with the story. It's one of the most moving fairy tales ever. And obviously it was written to console this little girl whom Wilhelm had written to. And she probably lost a parent. And the way you were moved was the way I was moved when I was making pictures.
Morning, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Everything that people have said so far goes the same for me, Mr. Sendak. It's been a pleasure to read you over the years. I had a question. I have a memory sort of dim about a book that I read when I was, or had it read to me when I was a child. It was, I think, by Robert Graves called The Big Green Book.
Yes.
And I was wondering if my memory is right. Did you illustrate that?
I certainly did.
I was wondering if you'd tell me anything about that book, because that really, I remember that to this day. It really affected me a lot.
That is one of the most demonic books ever written. And I bet you liked it.
I did. Loved
it. Because it's full of revenge.
Yep.
Small kids having revenge
the
on grown-ups.
To win his aunt and uncle's house away from them and so on.
Exactly, and he makes their nails grow right through their palms.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a wrathful book, and I was really lucky to get it because it's a Robert Graves book. I believe it's one of the only children's books he wrote, and it is a very funny book. It's just come back into print. Alas, not is The Big Green Book as it was designed, which was a big green book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit smaller, but it's still alive.
You can get it now? That's great.
All right, Eric. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Margaret and Laurel, you're on the air.
Well, I echo all of the wonderful comments that have been made so
good.
Far, and I do make a habit of looking at Sendak books for gifts. I sent Dear Millie to my goddaughter a couple of years ago, when it was first out at Christmas time, as mm-hmm. introduced. But I really called to tell you that my 2.5-year-old son really likes Where the Wild Things Are. And the other day, my husband was playing with him, and Peter looked him in the eye and said, "You marvelous beast." Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Delightful.
Thanks for calling. 885-8850. Lynn, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm another 30s baby, and apparently one of the few politically conservative women to call into your program, but I just want to say that I love the anatomically correct night season. I loved reading it to my grandchildren, and I echo everything that everybody said.
Lynn. Thanks so much for calling. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hello. Well, of course, I feel the same way all the other callers do about Mr. Sendak and his work. I had a comment that ever since this occurred, I've been interested. Once I was in the British Museum looking at illuminations, and I was struck by some German illuminations that really resembled the Beast and Where the Wild Things Are, and wondered if that was ever an inspiration for you. Now, and then I heard you say earlier that your inspiration for the Beast, but the work was just so strikingly similar. It was amazing to me.
Well, no, it wouldn't have been, although I have stolen from as many artists as you can count on any number of hands. But no, it was the relatives. And if my relatives were in illuminated manuscript, that is scarier than I can imagine.
Can you imagine? It goes all the way back to, a long time ago in Germany.
Too terrifying.
Oh, my God. Well, thank you so
much
for your work. You're quite an inspiration.
Thank you.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Sandy. Bye-bye. Norma, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi to Ms. Rame and Mr. Sender.
Yes.
When my daughter was a student at Whitman, I think it was, Walt Whitman High School here, one bits of inspired homework they were supposed to do was to contact somebody famous whom they admired and write to them. Look them up in the telephone book and write to them. And one of my daughters wrote to you. She looked up in the New York telephone book or something like that and wrote to you, and you sent her back a wonderful little postcard because she admired you and your work. And listen, I've read, my children were born from 1954 to 60, and I have read a lot of Sendak and enjoyed them. And you wrote her a postcard even had a little cartoon on it, which I hope she has saved. And in hearing you speak today, I'm impressed with what I wanted to say to you was I was impressed with that, and you seem to be so much more real to her. And in thinking, you are such a real person. But we started talking about storybooks, didn't we, that are supposed to be fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So I like your combination of it, and I appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I hope she still has the postcard.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Thanks, quite
a nice story.
I should tell you about a little boy who sent me a drawing, which was marvelous, many years ago. And I wrote back and sent him a drawing, hoping he'd like his as much as the one he sent me. And I got a letter from his mother saying, Edward liked your postcard so much, he ate it. So unless that woman's daughter did eat her picture, she might still have it.
Maurice Sendak, you had a heart attack at age 38.
Yep.
That probably had a pretty profound effect on your life.
Yep, it did. It made me realize what life begins at 40 means, meaning if you make 39. It also, traditionally, like it does with people, shapes up your life in some way and redefines things. And one was, I was shocked because without even being aware of it, I thought I was going to be spared so that I could work. And here I was faced with the same anxiety I was as a very small child, the acute vulnerability. So life after that meant working very hard and making really crucial creative decisions as to what it was I was going to be doing, and really carving up my life in such a way that it was almost entirely devoted in a monastic sense to working. So that even now, we talked about my starting a children's theater, I have to plan this very carefully because I have to walk in and out of bad health. And the only way to improve my health is to work. It's the best medicine. Doctors cannot provide that medicine. They simply can't. But creative labor can. And books and opera and my new theater all have come together to keep me going. And they have kept me going.
Has the realization of the health problem freed you in any way?
Yes, well, it's freed me from a lot of mundane things, a lot of worrisome career things and what you're going to do in life type things. I read only Herman Melville and Henry James and Jane Austen and George Eliot.
Sounds like my husband, yeah.
I read just the books I got to read. Mm-hmm. And people say, you're a snob. And I am a snob, I suppose. But I don't have time for the trivialities. I just won't take the time for the trivialities. I don't know how long it's going to be. And that isn't a morbid thought. I don't walk around thinking about dying. I just walk around thinking about living and how precious it is. And then there are so many wonderful books to read and wonderful bits of music to hear and just those few operas I really want to design and just those few books I really want to do and just this theater I really want to start, and I want to work with young people and teach them and be unto them what Ursula was to me. And when she died 2 years ago, I thought life was insupportable. But now I figured out what to do because with my theater, I can become Ursula.
The National Children's Theater you're talking about is called The Night Kitchen.
It's called The Night Kitchen.
Tell me how it operates.
Okay. It started a couple of years ago with me and Arthur Eurings, who is an old student of mine and has developed a beautiful career as a children's book writer and a librettist. And Arthur and his wife, Adrian, live just 10 minutes from where I live in Connecticut. So it's wonderful. He is my partner in The Night Kitchen. And we work together on projects. It is a not-for-profit children's theater, a national theater, which we hope, with success, will travel around the country. We'll do projects that are various and complicated and interesting, not just plays, but Well, we have Really Rosie, which I am bringing back, which I will redesign and which I will direct because I've been trying to direct. I've directed one opera already. There is an opera, Hansel and Gretel, which I'm designing right now for Toronto and New York and Night Kitchen, which is perfect for us as a theater. There is Peter Pan. Arthur and I will collaborate on a whole new version, not a musical version, but a play version, and I will design the Peter Pan. And then there's Arthur's book, Hey Al. So we have a series of projects which show the varieties of creative work that a child can enjoy, which it'll include books. I want to start a radio program because I grew up on radio, and I have the most passionate memories of hearing Let's Pretend with Nyla Mack.
Exactly.
With Nyla Mack. And I want that back. I still listen to the radio. I love hearing people read me stories while I'm drawing on the radio. And so this sounds very ambitious, and perhaps it's too ambitious because raising money in America today is, as you know, very difficult. But I am impassioned by this thing. I mean, I have become so obsessed with doing this. And we have gotten some money from my publisher. We endowed with $1 million to begin. And so we can start. And Rosie and Peter Pan and Hansel and Gretel are now in production. And we have a contract with SUNY Purchase in New York to use one of their theaters as a workshop because we didn't have a working space. And they're only a half hour drive away. So my whole life is getting encircled. So my health isn't in jeopardy anymore. I can just be around. Arthur's there and Adrian's there and SUNY Purchase is there and the occasional trip to New York. But people come to see me and the theater has begun. And you know what I have in my mind, and it's a conceit, I admit, but I grew up on Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the radio.
So did I.
And that passionate little group of people, those wonderful people who then appeared in Citizen Kane and creating something in a depression when there was no money, it can be done. And I just read a biography of Margaret Wise Brown, who is the mother of all children's books in America. I mean, people don't even know that she wrote Goodnight Moon and The Runaway Bunny. Her name is lost because children's books are condescended to and looked down on as a minor art form. To have a biography of Margaret out is going to change that, but also it'll show that how books began in America in the 30s, how children's books exploded in the 30s. There was a depression, too.
88.5, 88.50, a caller out in Great Falls. Jack, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
And good morning to Maury Sendak. This is Jack Reynolds from A Million Years Ago in New York.
And
I remember fondly, first of all, I'm delighted to hear that you have so many fans in Washington. And I remember a long, long time ago, we did a program, a series in New York called Children Explore Books.
Mm-hmm.
And you were kind enough to do the drawings which we used for the titles of the show.
I remember that.
And I also was struck, our kids who grew up in Hong Kong devoured your books.
Literally?
Just like the kid with the postcard.
Right.
You're very good for a high-fiber diet. But one of the things that struck me, Maurice, and I had not thought about this before, is that some of the static you're getting, I think, has to do with adults and nothing to do with children.
Oh, I agree with you.
They're still terrified of, and kids have the most macabre, wonderful senses of humor.
And kids are so busy protecting their parents and other adults from knowing what they know because they're so polite and good-natured, and they don't want to frighten their parents.
Well, in our case, with two now teenagers, they're still doing the same thing. But I think that you've really gone to the core of something in everyone's psyche, and the kids obviously love it, and they're smarter than adults anyway.
I'm afraid so.
And adults just are frightened, at least the ones you've been dealing with, like those silly librarians.
Yeah, right. And we're speaking very generally because there are marvelous adults who are on this wavelength.
Right.
All right, Jack, thanks so much for calling.
Righto.
Children in your own life. You have so many through your books. Mm-hmm. Has there ever been any desire on your part to have your own children?
Oh, sure. But I am a selfish and egotistical artist, and I would not have made a good father, as so many of my artist friends have not. So it was better not to. Plus, I had the privilege, sad one in a way, because my brother-in-law died reasonably young, and I helped my sister bring up my nephew and niece, which only proved what a ordinary and a bad parent I was. I love them, but I drove them crazy with demands. I did all the things that people do wrong. I have no pretensions to knowing more about doing it than most other people. I still love them, but we still have our problems. And then I'm in the fortunate position of being good uncle to all my friends' children. When they get totally fed up with their parents, they come to Maurice. So, and of course, those parents are infuriated that I get the best of their children. But I've had a wonderful time bringing up other people's children, quite like bringing up your own.
885-8850. Kathleen in McLean, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad to hear that Peter Pan is being reworked. But I do want to mention something. I don't know if you made the connection when you wrote In the Night Kitchen, but in the late 50s, when I was about 7 or 8, I had the fortune to go to a Catholic elementary school, and we were taught, which I think is a good analogy, that our souls are like a milk bottle. Hmm. Milk was delivered in those days, in bottles.
Yes, of course.
That when we did something wrong, sometimes our soul will get dark, but when we made things better, it will become pure white again like a milk bottle. And I thought you would want to know about that.
That's very beautiful. I've never, ever heard that. I love knowing that. I love knowing that because it just enriches everything about what's happening. That milk bottle is a whole other thing to me, but it's lovely to hear that. It's a beautiful image.
What was it to you then?
Milk bottle to me was the clinking early in the morning at dawn because I was an insomniac as a child, and I could visualize the milkman coming. I could hear the horse pawing in the street, the tinkle coming up the steps, the clank of those beautiful bottles, the deposit in the front door. Am I rushing to the door to get that fresh smell? Mm-hmm. I just love that. And also, I must be honest with you, in the Night Kitchen, it's the Empire State Building.
Oh.
Because my favorite movie was King Kong. And there it was. The giant milk bottle was the Empire State. And there's Mickey and his airplane going around the top like those airplanes that done in our beloved Kong.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful exchange between you and Kathleen. Thanks for calling. Karen in Bethesda, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a book of German romantic painting, and I was looking through it one day and saw a painting of fat-cheeked children with sunflowers in the background, and it all clicked into place. I was just thrilled with the way that you took that and used it, and I wonder if I keep looking, will I find other things like that, sources that you've used?
Oh, I'm a big thief. You will find much, but I bet you the picture you looked at was something called the Hulsenbecker Kinder by Philip Otto Runger.
Yes.
That's one of the greatest paintings of all time for the animalistic passion of children. And I stole from him in Dear Millie, and his name is entwined in the leaves. And as punishment, I named my German Shepherd Runga. So I have to repeat his name over and over and over again.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for calling, Karen. Let's go to Kent Island. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi.
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 I wanted to ask him if he was going to write any other books about his characters in the, like, Max and Mickey.
I hope I do. I don't know to tell you the truth, Sam. I don't know, because you don't know when a book is going to happen. You know, it's a little bit like a quiet explosion in your head. And you always hope it's going to happen, but you don't know. So keep your fingers crossed for me that another Max or Mickey's on the way.
And my brothers really like your books, and my parents own a toy store, own toy stores.
You sound like a lucky kid.
Called Beep Beep, and once you came to one of them and autographed.
Great.
Stuffed animal that we have.
Sam, how old are you?
11.
Well, I'm awfully glad you called in
Me
this
too.
Morning. Thanks
Me
a lot.
Too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sam.
And a caller in Fairfax. Helen, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Mrs. Cream and Maurice.
Good morning.
I'd like to say that I was a student in Maurice Sendak's illustration class at Parsons in 1976. And I don't know if you remember me. My name is Helen Euland. But
I do now. I heard the last name.
I just want to say that some of the things that you taught us as seniors in college, I've used all through my professional life. Mm. I'm now teaching illustration down here in Fairfax.
Good for you. Good for you.
As well as working, and I've been encouraging my students to steal, too.
I told you all to be crooks, didn't I?
Absolutely. And they just are horrified when they first hear about it, but once they realize that we all learn from each other and we artists need to borrow from each other, their work comes alive.
It's much more real, isn't it, to say that that's how it has to happen, and it's facetious to say thievery and stealing, because it really is learning.
It absolutely.
And it's the only way to learn is to be honest and look and take and make it into your own work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Helen.
Good to hear from
you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Talk about that teaching process for you and how you have been in relationship with your students as you teach.
It may seem paradoxical, Diane, because how much I hated school that I would then end up a teacher.
Exactly.
But I knew what was missing. I knew what kids like me needed. And I gave a workshop. I gave a workshop at Yale for a year. I gave a workshop at Parsons in New York. And it was simply to be Papa protective. You get students who are so gifted. I mean, it's there. It's in the wiring. You don't teach people to be gifted. There are those that are, and there are those that never will be. But the ones that are tremendously high-strung, ready to go, and they need the kind of encouragement and affection that a teacher can give you. You don't teach talented people. You only support them. You spend a lot of time talking to their parents on the phone, and if they're female students, and there's a lot of discussion with parents about let this kid go, even though she's a girl, and let her be an artist. You'd be amazed how nothing has changed when it comes to that. And so I was a support system and a helper so that the very gifted ones could get out in the world and begin to work with my help. That's really what I did, and that's what I wanted to do, and I'd help them through a book. The only thing they had to do in class was to write and illustrate a book, or for those who only illustrated, pick a Mother Goose rhyme or a fairy tale and do the pictures. You didn't have to finish the book. There was no grading. I tried to take all that hideous pressure out of it. Strangely, it didn't work as well as I liked because it was attached to colleges where they were affronted and assaulted by other systems that zapped their energies. And I don't want to harp on my theater. I don't. But this is the way I'm going to teach. And as an artist, in my theater, there's no college. They don't have to worry about other grades. They just have to come, work, and I'll put them right on stage, and I can do what I couldn't do as a teacher in a college, employ them and pay them. That's the big thing, to pay them.
DJ, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Diane.
Morning.
Morning.
Hi.
I'm a young illustrator, and I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about the inception of Where the Wild Things Are as far as presenting that to an editor or a publisher, considering how controversial it was.
Well, you see, it didn't start out as controversial, and Ursula was very far out, and I was a little far out, so we didn't see anything odd about this, but I'll give you a quick history of how mundane and ordinary is the process of creative labor. And the first thing was called Where the Wild Horses Are, and I showed her a little version of it, and she loved it, and we both got excited. We thought the title was so entrancing, but when I began to draw, I couldn't draw horses, okay? And so that was the end of the poetic title. And then I drew other things, and they were just as bad. And she was getting nervous because she already put a down payment on the book of $500. And she said, Maurice, what can you draw? And so I decided things, because things, anything, maybe even I could draw.
Uh-huh.
That's simply how the book began. I knew what it was about. There was going to be a little boy having a confrontational meeting with his mother, and he's going to be put in his room, and he's going to have a fantasy. What the fantasy was about was the problem. And then once I got to see that it was my relatives that were the nightmares in my life, that was solved. And I got it all together. It took 3 years, 2 years to write over and over. And you know, it's only less than 385 words, but it's like a poetic form. You have to get each word perfectly correct. And you don't do pictures that echo the word. You do pictures that tell another story on top of the word. So it's like music with two themes going in and out. And you have to concentrate because the picture book is the most beautiful and exciting form to work in. If you're beginning, enjoy it. Don't get uptight. Enjoy it and reinvent it for the next generation.
Right.
DJ, thanks so much for calling. Good luck to you.
Thanks. Bye.
You have taken me precisely where I wanted to go, which is to ask you whether you are truly enjoying yourself now. It seems to me I read that you said somewhere that enjoying yourself or taking pleasure out of life was not something that came easily in your family.
It was not. It was a very unhappy household. I was treated well and I was loved, but we lived under the doom cloud of World War II. Again, typical of a generation. But I am happy now. I'm happy to report. It began in my 50s, when I did Outside Over There, and when I began to, Outside Over There was it was an exorcism. It was getting rid of so much that had burdened me in my life in a work of art. Maybe that's why I love it so much, because it carried away finally like the waters in that book, all the sadness and all the troubles. And then after that, it really got better. And I was one of those human beings that has to wait to be happy. And I'm grateful. I got to be happy in my 50s, and I'm now in my 60s, and with the prospect of the theater, with the prospect of illustrating Herman Melville's Pierre, my first grown-up book, and doing homage to my greatest hero in American literature. I'm not only happy, I'm excited. Every prospect is before me. It's funny and ironical that you have to wait till your 60s, but who are you going to complain to?
Well, and some people never.
And some people never, correct. I adore my sister, and she never will. My sister is 70, and she comes from the same cloudy family. And so I see that. You're right. You're right. I'm a very lucky man.
Well, and I feel myself to be a very lucky woman to have had a chance to talk with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Diane. I've enjoyed it.